Congress didn't fully understand us as a people. And so they tried to deal through these institutions with what they perceived to be the kind of a settlement that we needed. And this is what I heard the elders say then in 1968 and 69, and it's what I hear them saying today, very loudly and very clearly. And I'll say no more about sovereignty until a later time. But again, sovereignty is an outgrowth of that aspiration. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Wright, would you like to make a further contribution at this stage, or?
Yes, as a matter of fact, listening to the testimony and remembering that I participated in most of the hearings that were held by the Congress, as well as most of the hearings and meetings that were held by the Native people during this time, kind of a condensed version of what the people on the Native side wanted was contained in a statement that I made at the White House press conference to President Nixon on an occasion that I met with him when he overturned his Secretary of Interior position on land claims and was the first to come out with a bill anywhere near the requested bill of the Alaskan Native people. And I'd like to read it and put it into the record because I'm not sure that it's been distributed widely. And this was on April the 6th in 1971. For the past several months, I and other representatives of the Alaska Federation of Natives have been working closely with the administration to assist them in formulating their position on the Alaska Native land claims. I have met today with the President to discuss the progress of these negotiations and to give him my views with respect to the administration's position on this important national issue. I told the President that the historical dimension of this legislation is immense. Either it will go down in history as the most enlightened and equitable act of the United States government toward Native American, or it will be recorded as merely the last chapter of a tragic record of expropriation of Native American land and property rights. The President and the Congress must decide whether this last chapter is to be written in dignity or dishonor. I also told the President that a just and equitable settlement of our land rights in Alaska is by far the most important and difficult Indian issue to be dealt with under his presidency. There are many powerful vested interests which are actively opposing our land rights in Alaska, both within and outside of his administration. A just settlement cannot be achieved without the President's strong and continuing support and leadership. Because of our use and occupancies of the land in Alaska for literally thousands of years, the Alaska Natives have valid Indian title to roughly 375 million acres of land in Alaska. This title has never been extinguished by the United States since it negotiated with Russia and signed the Treaty of Cession in 1867. To secure these land rights, the Alaska Federation of Natives, after extensive and careful deliberations, proposed a settlement which would confirm our title to 60 million acres of land, and as compensation for relinquishing our title to over 300 million acres, we have proposed a federal cash appropriation of $500 million payable with interest over a 9-year period and a perpetual royalty of 2% in all minerals taken from lands in the state. Our proposal has been introduced in the Senate as S-835, sponsored by 13 distinguished senators, and as H.R. 7039 in the House with 25 distinguished House sponsors. The AFN most emphatically reconfirms its commitment to the position embodied in these bills and its intention to continue to seek a settlement on this basis. The administration is today sending to the Hill a proposal which would confirm our title to 40 million acres of land. This title would be a full and complete grant of all rights, surface as well as mineral. As compensation for extinguishing our title to those remaining lands in Alaska and the minerals beneath those lands, the administration proposes that it would authorize payment of $500 million from the federal treasury over the next 20 years and an additional $500 million from the state of Alaska's share of mineral royalties from lands throughout the state. I told the president that the administration's position constitutes a positive and constructive contribution towards achieving a just settlement of our land right. It is the most responsive position yet taken by any national administration on this issue. We commend the president for his attention to the awareness of our property rights and his sympathetic hearing of our case. The president's invitation to confer with him today demonstrates not only the good faith of the administration, but the truly national importance of this issue. The Alaska Federation of Natives regards the administration's position as a foundation upon which a truly just settlement can be built. We do not, however, regard this as President Nixon's final position, and we will continue to press for his support for the full AFN position. I want to make it perfectly clear that we do not in any way regard the administration's bill as a substitute for the AFN bills S-835 and H-R-7039, which are presently under consideration in the House and the Senate. I'm especially gratified that the administration's position clearly indicates that it recognizes the validity of our property rights in Alaska land, and it is not based on some concept of gift or welfare. To 60,000 Eskimo, Indian, and Aleut people in Alaska, our land, the very basis of our lives, the real issue is not how much land we will be given, but how much of our land we will be permitted to retain and how much will be released to the United States and on what terms. Because the land is the basis of our culture, the heart of our way of life, and the very means for our survival, our slogan for this effort has been, take our land, take our life. In reaching its position, the administration is coming far closer to our position than has either body of the Congress to this day. The administration has vindicated its policy of Indian self-determination and has shown that it spoke honestly when it announced last summer a new policy of dealing fairly with Native people. The administration has not acted in a unilateral fashion. In response to our requests for consultation and involvement, they listened to us and they responded. For this, the Native people of Alaska are indeed grateful. Finally, let me emphasize how much today means to all of our Native people scattered across the face of Alaska in 200 villages, the people who are the true owners and stewards of our Alaskan lands. Our people have sent me and my fellow officers and directors of the Alaska Federation of Natives to Washington to negotiate a fair and equitable settlement with the United States. They are eager, if not at times a bit fearfully, watching and waiting to see what we accomplish. It is their future and that of their children, which is at stake, and we will not fail them. We have put our trust in our government, which alone can translate hope into justice. The Alaska Federation of Natives now calls upon Congress to act promptly, to settle Alaska land claims, and to bring justice to our people and peace to our lands. We ask all Americans to join us in our fight for justice. Now, this paper summarized, in my view, the direction that we were given by the elders like Alfred Starr, by the elders like Frank Degnan, by the elders like Al Hobbs and Eben Hobson's father, Roy Ewan's family, Carter's family, Richard Frank's family, Mrs. McGarvey's family. This summarizes it, but I want to reemphasize that no matter how hard we fight, and no matter what our real legal rights are, and no matter how sympathetic a president like Mr. Nixon wants to be, he is still overpowered by the influence of the major oil companies, the major economic forces, to take from the Native people because they're lesser in number and weaker in education and money to fight with. And even a president, he probably would have gladly, in a straight-out negotiation, one-on-one, gladly conceded to our wishes, honorably, in a true negotiation. But under the mandate of Congress, he couldn't do that. And under the mandate of Congress, those special interests continually eroded away even the position of the highest officer in the United States at our expense. And I submit that, once again, I consider it an arbitrary mandate of the Congress of the United States, and I don't believe the door is closed. And I think we've got a long way to go, and I think it's important that the international aspects are now being considered, and that at some point there will be a reconsideration and justice will truly have been done.
I'm trying to remember the order in which we went yesterday. Was it Mr. Allen or Mr. Paul who? Mr. Allen, yes, sorry. Mr. Carter, forgive me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of brief comments. I wished Mr. Upickson were here, or Etuk, because they could more eloquently describe a problem that I don't think has been touched on at all here. When the Native Claims Settlement Act came to a vote of the Native people at the AFN here in 1971, the North Slope did not agree to the Settlement Act, although it has been subsequently forced upon them by passage of Congress. One of their major considerations, and it has been even until recently, when their appeal has been denied by a court of law. And I remember very clearly when I first met Mr. Degnan in Unalakleet, it was one of his concerns also, and in fact was a part of the claim that Francis mentioned that those people made over there in that area. And it included the subsistence areas of those people, seaward, for a considerable distance. When we were arguing over provisions of the Settlement Act at the AFN level, it was mentioned numerous times but discarded. The Cognac people and the Aleut people also live off the sea substantially. And as a part of their cultural and traditional and heritage background, their subsistence, the ocean and the waters are extremely important. So when we talk about lands for a settlement, it's not only lands, it's the waters around us. It's where the animals live. It's where we get our living from. And the air about us. We don't want it polluted like Los Angeles. And we don't want the acid rains like they're experiencing on the East Coast. So when you consider a settlement with the other peoples, I hope you take into consideration the entire area of their livelihood and involvement and their cultural heritage. Another problem that has not been mentioned here that we addressed at the AFN level and tried to get assurances from the national administration and the people in Congress was the continued obligation of the government to assist all people, and especially those people who did not have advantages to gain livelihoods in the cash world. There was a provision in the Act that provided that the Interior Department would do an assessment of programs aimed at Alaska Natives and health, education, welfare, housing, and so forth. And that we were fearful that the settlement would be viewed in such a fashion that these programs would be terminated for Alaska Natives. I had some small part to play in developing a report as co-chairman here in Alaska with Bert Hall, who was assigned from the federal agencies to co-chair a committee to develop that report. And it was an eye-opener, to say the least. If I recall correctly, the estimated round dollar figure amount that was being spent in Alaska for Alaska Natives in health, education, welfare, and other programs amounted somewhere in the neighborhood of $300 million per year. And if we, through our corporations, had to substitute those services, it would have been absolutely impossible. We would have been broke the first year of our operations. Since the Settlement Act has passed, there have been some terminations. There have been reductions in budgets for these types of services. And our people are feeling the effect of those now, and our shareholders are looking upon the corporations to try to substitute in some way the benefits that have been lost. And I'll tell you, it's impossible. So that is a very serious problem that must be considered. The retention or provision, as you would anybody in need for benefits in those areas. Another problem, I think, is a jurisdictional problem. Our corporations were established under the laws of the state of Alaska. We knew very early in the game that in order for the village corporations to survive, that they would have to form consolidated units because they could not afford the expertise of lawyers, each one of them. Small villages, some with less than 100 people, couldn't have lawyers and pay for accountants and other consultants in order to survive as a business entity, and that there would have to be consolidations and mergers. We didn't provide in the first place under ANCSA exemptions or under the Federal Securities and Exchange Commission rules. And not until 1976, I believe, when we secured an amendment to ANCSA that allowed us a federal exemption of SEC requirements in consolidation and mergers of business corporations. What we failed to do, however, was to ensure that those same exemptions would be granted under state law. My corporation has been going under legal problems because of state SEC regulations, and it has literally cost us millions and millions of dollars. Some of our shareholders, and I'm sure that you will find this when a settlement is made elsewhere, become interested in the power structures that are created by these institutions. And will try to use the white man's law for their own purposes, whether it be power purpose or greed purpose. I hope that you will consider a tribal jurisdictional resolution to shareholders' interests in their own corporations and try to stay away from white man's law. Thank you.
Mr. Paul, would you like to pick up the discussion at this point?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of important background backdrop to the Settlement Act. One of the frustrations that I did not mention, which plagued the people through the decades, was allotments. We've had quite a bit of discussion this morning about allotments. The Federal Field Committee report has the facts and figures about the number of acres allotted under the Indian Allotment Act of 1906. As of 1962, there were 15,000 some odd acres allotted to the Alaskan Natives. That's 56 years of administration of authority to have allotments. My neighbor here, Mr. Starr, was frustrated by these allotments, and I'm sure that it plagued the rest of the natives of Alaska. In comparison, the homestead laws, there were roughly 500,000 acres patented to the white people through the homestead laws. So you have a conclusion to be drawn that the General Land Office, what we used to call it, now the Bureau of Land Management, was bitterly opposed to the processing of applications for allotments. And it led to great frustration among the people. Now, another fact should be mentioned, and that is what I call, from the North Slope called, Senator Jackson was determined to bring the Alaska Natives, yelling and screaming, into the 20th century in one fell swoop. His great motto was, we're not going to have any racial enclaves. In part, that was a product of his experience in the state of Washington. This is prior to the Bolt decision, but even by 1971...
B-O-L-D-T.
B-O-L-D-T.
I'm just saying for the record.
Right. B-O-L-D-T, Judge Bolt. But even as of 1971, there were several major decisions interpreting the fishing rights of the state of Washington Indians under their respective treaties. There was a huge conflict about criminal jurisdiction on Indian reservations, huge conflict about civil jurisdiction. For example, if an Indian had a car wreck on an Indian reservation injuring some white person, was there a court which could give redress to the injured party? So his great motto was he was going to, I don't think he ever used these words, but this is what we used in characterizing his attitude. We're going to bring the Alaska Natives into the 20th century yelling and screaming. There's one of the handicaps in Western society is the natural reluctance by the Alaska Natives. And I think this is part of the cultural traits of all of the various tribes we have up here. They do not like to insult a person to his face. They'll always agree with you. I remember a story my father told about Peter Simpson, one of our great leaders in Southeast. He went to my father and said, you know, an Indian never say no. Well, tell me, Peter, when he say yes, but he mean no, how do you know when he say yes, he mean no? When he don't do it, he mean no. In Western society, in the political process of achieving some good social goal, the political process demands that you raise hell, then you get some relief. For example, in the early 60s, there was a big conflagration down in Los Angeles. We call it the Watts. The blacks down there went rampaging up and down their area, burning buildings and looting stores. And as a result of that conflagration, that rebellion, that upheaval, the United States of America poured in $100 million. For the Alaska Natives to go back to Washington, D.C., and to, in a sense, insult the Congress by, in a different form, yelling and screaming, it's foreign to their culture. They do not like to be angry at the Alaska Miners Association when George Borlein told a congressional committee in 69, the American public doesn't owe one penny to the Alaska Natives, and they don't deserve 1 acre of land. You know, it's a beautiful quote, not 1 acre of land or one penny. Beautiful quote. They don't like to go up to the Alaska Miners Association and say, you know, you're stealing this from us. It's against their culture. Incidentally, maybe the Indian culture is the better system. But that's not the political process. Now, one of the problems we had is a certain number of givens, axioms, rules that our advisors imposed upon us. Take the issue of sovereignty. The Goldberg firm of lawyers believed that there would be no possibility of persuading Senator Jackson to have in the bill any protection for the sovereignty of the Indian tribes, native tribes up here. It was a verboten subject. We could not talk about it. Well, fortunately, the Arctic Slope Eskimos had some understanding of the political process that I've described, and they were angry. They could see the oil wells being dug. You know, it's almost a figurative rape. And I can remember in the 1969 hearings, I threatened to bring a lawsuit to enjoin the September 1969 sale. That is, this is the hearings were after the sale, but we were going to tie up the money. We were going to sue the Bank of America, who was the custodian of the money, so that the state couldn't spend the $900 million. And we issued a press release. Well, Peter A.A. Burley, one of the Goldberg team of lawyers, made fun of me. More than that, he ridiculed me. That you are being counterproductive. You are hurting the native cause. Even such a saint as Howard Rock, and I don't imagine there is a person in my lifetime that I respect more than Howard Rock. He did not print my threat to sue the state of Alaska on the $900 million because he didn't approve. He had some of this cultural trait, which I say that I personally admire, but it is not a part of the Western society's political process. So we really made no real headway in trying to get into the bill any protection of sovereignty. I've already recounted the Arctic Slope's efforts at utilizing the IRAs as the vehicle for the settlement. And I've already, aside from Don, I've already said that no native leader supported such the utility of utilizing an IRA. That was one of our givens. We couldn't talk about sovereignty. We couldn't talk about utilizing a different system than corporations. How many times did we talk about corporations? We had ghost corporations, we had sister corporations, we had charitable corporations. We had statewide corporations, we had village corporations, but it was always corporations. I enjoyed Harry Carter's reference to the Arctic Slope Native Association in opposing the settlement. I really enjoyed your remark, Harry. I wrote Joe's speech. That is the way I felt. My father believed that when the settlement gave us roughly 10% of our land, we didn't preserve 10% of our land. No. Western society stole 90%. And he was bitterly opposed to the settlement and telegraphed the president to veto, as did the Arctic Slope. Now, somebody, on one of these questions that Ann's written out here, she was characterizing Richard Frank's desire of perpetual membership. Of course, that is the concept of an IRA. The IRA, the tribe owns it, and when a member of the tribe dies, he leaves no personal estate. It still belongs to the tribe. That is, his membership in the tribal property is there for the other members, including the man's children. But it's not a probate piece of property where you go to court and your children inherit by means of a piece of paper a property interest in the tribal asset. The tribal asset is there for your children to utilize. So in the sense, they do inherit, but not the way a white man inherits. The Central Council of Tlingit-Haida Indians is an example of perpetual membership. When a member of the Central Council dies, we don't list in the probate papers an asset by reason of his membership in the Central Council. Likewise, when a child is born, he automatically, by means of his birth, becomes a member of the Central Council. He's got to be registered and enrolled, but that's easily accomplished. When an IRA has an asset and the person is born within the area of his particular IRA, he becomes automatically a member of that IRA. The IRA is a vehicle for having perpetual membership. Now, the last question on Ann's list relates to subsistence. I want to reiterate what I said earlier about limited entry. And part of subsistence is also, in Western society's terms, the right to catch a few fish for the cash economy, as well as catching a few fish to eat for subsistence. So that when we talk about subsistence, in a sense it excludes the commercial aspects of fishing off of your old hunting grounds and your old fishing grounds. But I remember being at Tanana a year or so ago, and I asked the people there, how many fish wheels you got permits for here in Tanana? They said, 6. Tell me, 50 years ago, how many fish wheels did you have there? 40, 50, maybe 100 up and down the river. So that I prefer to have to utilize a broader term than subsistence. Subsistence implies that you're going to eat it. But in Western society's environment, you got to buy some things. We don't have sled dogs anymore. We got snowmobiles. You got to buy a snowmobile so you can go out and hunt. Go to your fish camp. So the term should not be merely subsistence, but it should be the right to live off the land for money, yes, and for food. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Paul. By the way, I've obtained a copy of Mr. Langdon's paper on limited entry, and I'm grateful to you for mentioning that.
Mr. Kozlov's paper is excellent.
Oh, I'll have to locate that one.
Yes, it's a study of four villages in Bristol Bay, and an emotional man would cry in reading it of the failure of those four villages to have limited entry permits. They didn't apply for them. The statistics, the data about young men in their 20s and 30s who are on the beach, and of course it's a one economy area, fish, that's all there is. So they're on welfare, and I don't know why the people of Alaska don't rebel at the enlargement of the welfare rolls because of the failure of the indigenous people to go out as they have done through the centuries to earn a living by fishing, but they haven't awakened yet. So there we have welfare.
Mr. Frank, would you like to add something at this point?
Please, thank you, Mr. Chairman. the statement I made was interpreted very thoroughly by Mr. Paul. The Land Claims Act itself, I'd like to speak on that a little more. The land itself was the most important factor to Native people in Alaska. It was persistently educated among the young Native people to get a hold of the land and keep it. And this was one of the first strong issues that unified the Native people of Alaska. The present Land Claims Act itself involves some monies with the land claims itself. In the early days, it wasn't really anticipated that there will be money involved. The main thing was getting a hold of the land. When money becomes involved, it is general practice that there is a deadline that has to be met by the Western factor. Land among Native people, there was no deadline. And those two issues for future settlement, and I'm pretty sure that there will be another settlement regarding the Native people after the birth of December 1971, that they will have more leverage and more things, more assets to look at to go to Congress and use these. In the last AFN meeting, these are things that they discussed, that there was two separate issues with other people that's looking other for settlement. I think these are the things that should be addressed very thoroughly. The cultural integrity. One of the strong points that was exercised was Native religion. These are things that should be inserted. We have to fight the state. We have to fight the other agencies for these recognition. Prime example, Frank's potlatch case of Minto versus the state. One of the saddest things among the Native people here in Alaska, and I'm sure with other countries that are looking for settlement, and generally worldwide, is losing our native tongue. It, like Mr. Borbridge was saying, tribal identity. These are things that was exercised in the past. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Frank.
Yes.
About limited entry. The finest statistics on the transfer of the permits is the annual report of the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. And I think the last time I saw them was about 1981. And as of then, depending on my memory, but to give the commissioner a flavor of what's available, I think about 65% of the permits statewide had been transferred. Steve Langdon's report is, I think, out of date, and but it started a trend. But there's bound to be a lot of natives who have transferred their permits when 65% of them have been transferred.
I didn't quite follow that. Were you implying that 65% of Native people holding permits had transferred them?
No, 65% of those who got free permits back in 74 have been transferred. That would be Native and non-Native.
Okay, I'll bear that in mind. Well, thanks for coming, Mr. Frank.
Mr. Lekanoff, we could turn to you now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, John. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a story to tell. Then I have one of the questions down here that are very pertinent that was touched upon by Mr. Carter. Among other things, back in 1968, Mr. Wright, as you will recall, Jim Thomas and I helped you as president of AFN and collected food from all over Alaska. We got muktuk from Nome and dried fish from Unalakleet, king crab from Kodiak. We even got some ugruk from up Nome area, caribou from the interior, moose, name it, and we got just about every Alaska Native food, seafood, by the way, much of it came from Angoon, the village of Angoon, seaweed, and put down on this big feed in Washington. We invited all the congressmen and their wives, the hierarchy of the White House and everyone influential that we could think of that we might influence to that Alaskan feed. And it was quite timely. It was in January, I think latter part of January, and the very strong chairman of the House Interior and Insular Affairs Committee, Wayne Aspinall, had just returned from Europe visiting his son. He was very proud. His son was in the service, and he was in good spirits and so forth. And so I think if one thing was accomplished as a means of getting to important people, that feed culminated in a visit at a table between myself and President Don Wright with Wayne Aspinall. I mention that because I think that Don Wright turned Aspinall around at that meeting. He was very arrogantly opposed to many of the suggestions that had been made to him in his office and in the committee and testimonies, many of them before him. And he was adamant and very stern on his stands until that time. And I wanted to mention that because I think that there's another little story connected to that feed that I'd like to tell you, just for a little easement here. One of Congressman Pollock's aides helped me put the muckduck into dices, and we had to keep the muckduck refrigerated, you know, so it wouldn't melt away. And we diced them up into a little larger than a sugar cube, you know, and put toothpick in them and set them up in the refrigerator and so forth. And this lady got very curious. She never had tasted muckduck before. She said, we were going to serve these as hors d'oeuvres. She said, well, I'd like to taste one of those. May I have a permission to take one of these and taste it, but please tell me first what it's going to taste like. I said, well, you know, you chew on it for a while, and it begins to taste like coconut. And then with that, she took one of the pieces and stuck it in her mouth, and she started chewing. 2 minutes later, she came back to me and says, well, where's the coconut taste? I haven't gotten it yet.